Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the world's most skilled mountaineers challenge themselves in a world of ever more extreme achievements? Half a century ago, teams of climbers took months to create routes and days to physically ascend the granite walls of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park, aided by hardware embedded in the rock and protected by safety harnesses. But over the past few years, a small subset of free solo climbers have set out to make many of the same climbs without ropes or gear and at speeds that almost defy belief. Mark Jenkins is a contributing writer to National Geographic. His article about Yosemite's super climbers is the cover story for the May 2011 issue of the magazine. Mark, welcome to THINK.
It's good to be back, Chris.
What do free solo climbers rely on to get themselves up the sides of these mountains?
I would have to say it's a Zen-like focus. I mean, these guys are trained beyond what we can normally imagine. They've been working very, very hard for at least a decade, most of them, to train their body and their mind to be able to do things that ordinary climbers cannot do.
At the very start of this piece, you put us alongside a free solo climber named Alex Honnold in a very precarious position. And the potential disaster that he faces is not physical weakness in this case. It's a mental thing.
It is. Alex free soloed Half Dome. Now, to explain free soloing, we used to have something called free climbing, and it's still here, but free climbing, you climb with a rope. Mm-hmm. Free soloing, you climb without a rope. Therefore, if you make any mistake at any moment, you die. It's like a basketball player who would be forced to make every single shot, or a field goal kicker who is forced upon execution, or the pain and penalty of execution, to make every single kick. That's the level of professionalism. It's hard to understand. Most of these climbers that are free soloing have dedicated, 5 to 10 hours a day every day for a decade, focused on entirely on climbing.
And unlike in Europe, where it's not as difficult, it's really hard for these guys to get sponsors, isn't it?
They are. We don't have the same background. Switzerland, in particular, has this great heritage of rock climbing. Rock climbing in Switzerland would be like basketball in America or something like that. So there are professional European climbers, whereas professional American climbers, most of them still live in their van, and they're lucky if they get $20,000 a year to be a pro climber, whereas pro climbers in some of the European countries, France and Switzerland, make a fine living.
Is part of the problem that U.S. companies are afraid to sponsor somebody who might end up smashed at the bottom of a mountain?
I don't think that's it. I think that it's more an issue of what the heritage of professional sports is in America, and those are big team sports. And that's not necessarily the case for someplace like Switzerland or the French Alps, where individual achievements are considered as great as team achievements.
So, Mark, tell us about Half Dome, which is what Alex Honnold climbed and set this free solo record. What is the route up that part of the mountain?
Well, the route, it's Half Dome. The technical side of it is a 2,000-foot wall, and even the base of starting that 2,000-foot wall is already 2,500 feet above the valley floor. So when you get to the top of Half Dome and you look down into Yosemite Valley, you're basically a mile above that valley. And for Alex to free solo this face is just utterly stunning. For those of us who've climbed for many years, I mean, we climb with a rope, and the rope is your protection. If you fail physically or if you fail mentally, you fall, but the rope catches you. You may fall 15 feet or you may fall 50 feet. Likely it's not. You probably won't get hurt other than some scrapes. You could break an arm, but generally speaking, people don't get hurt that badly when they fall in Yosemite. It's very common. But you have to have such powers of concentration to climb with knowing that during any fatigue at all, if your fingers can't hold on, if your fingertips can't hold on, and you let go, you fall 2,000 feet. So it's remarkable. They brought the sport to a level of mortality that most of us can't even imagine, and that's for climbers who I climb all the time.
Yeah, you climb all the time. Have you free soloed in the past, even up a small area?
Sure, I have. I think those of us who've climbed a lot have free soloed, but not at that same level. Mm-hmm. It's very, very different. I mean, there are portions of this climb on Half Dome where you literally have to smear your fingertips onto this vertical granite face to move upward, and there's nothing to really hold on to. They're just tiny, what we call dime edges, meaning that they're the thickness of a dime, which is, what, 2 millimeters or something like that. And you're grabbing with your fingernails on that, and you're smearing your rubber-soled rock shoes on that dime edge.
Yeah, what is the sole like? There's nothing on it that's sticky, right? Can you talk a little bit about those shoes?
Sure. Shoes, as has all technology in climbing, have evolved over the last 50 years. Climbing, rock climbing at the level that's done at Yosemite was an offshoot of standard mountaineering, where you wore a big hiking boot with mm-hmm. a Vibram sole, and you crunched up through snow and did some rock climbing and got to the summit. But over the last 50 years, things have become much more specialized, and the shoes that we now have what we call sticky rubber. Now, it's not really sticky like glue, but it's much softer rubber than a Vibram hiking boot sole. So it will stick to tiny edges that the Vibram your old hiking shoe wouldn't. They're very tight. They tend to hurt your feet because you want them so tight that you can feel the rock on your toes right through the rock. Hmm. I mean, right through the shoe, excuse me.
Yeah. So obviously you have to have this amazing concentration, but also confidence. And it seems like going, half an inch too far on one side or the other is deadly. Because if you think too much about what you're doing, it has to occur to you that this is a really stupid idea and you could die.
Yeah, I think I don't think they see it as a stupid idea. I think what it is it's raising the level of expertise to kind of beyond what most of us can imagine in terms of sport. It is a mortal business, and you can never lose your concentration. Speaking with Alex, he said, I climb every day, and I climb all day, so my fingers, my body, they're perfectly fit. The problem is to have that level of concentration. Now, he did Half Dome in 2.5 hours or something like that. It was first done, when it was first done, it took 5 days. And now it's down to, the day before I'd been up near Alex, and two climbers had come to the top, and they'd taken 3 days to climb it, which is still normal. Taking 3 days to do something that he did under 3 hours. So these are super athletes. These are the Olympians of rock climbing.
Yeah. Describe for me a portaledge, or for us, a portaledge, and is that what people use if they're going to take a couple of days to do this?
Exactly. They use the portaledge. Now, this is a tent that hangs on a vertical wall, and they're kind of quite fun. Imagine a cot. Imagine a two-person cot, actually. That would probably be something that's maybe 4 to 5 feet wide and 6.5 feet long, and it's just a cot. There's an aluminum framing around it, and then there are four straps that come up from each corner, and they attach at a loop at the top, and that loop is clipped onto a piece in the rock, and you're hanging there. Now, a tent, a canopy, comes over those four straps, so if it rains, you stay dry for the most part. So this is how you move up a wall that's vertical, is you have a tent that goes with you, and the tent is a portaledge.
And they can spend the whole night there and then pack it back up again. And the shot that you have in here, we should say, by the way, Jimmy Chin's photographs are absolutely amazing. But it looks like in the shot that you have, these guys are hundreds of feet above what any of us would consider a good place to sort of set one's feet down.
Well, on a vertical wall, you don't really set one's feet down, actually. You're always climbing up. So, yes, typically using a portaledge, you'll climb several hundred feet up each day. And then you'll be dragging up this haul bag that has your portaledge, which is essentially just your hanging tent, in this haul bag. And then you set it up, and you spend the night there. You cook. You have coffee. Just as if you were camping on the ground, except for you're 500 to 1,000 feet off the ground. And if you drop anything, you won't get it back.
Mark, do climbers have no fear of heights, or do they control their fear of heights?
That's a very good question. I think that this is one of the common myths about climbers. Almost every climber I've met has a fear of heights. In fact, they have enormous respect for heights, but they control it. They're not that different in the sense that I think most climbers, if you were to take them to the top of the Eiffel Tower or something and just have them look over right off the bat, they all get that kind of thrill of vertigo. But they, when you're climbing up, you control that fear. And that's one of the great skills of a rock climber, that is that the fear of falling is innate. We're born with it. A child is 6 months old has a fear of falling. And so you don't eliminate your fear of falling, you control it.
Mark Jenkins is my guest. He's a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine and has the cover story in the May 2011 issue. We'll get back to our discussion with Mark in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. We would like to invite you to join us as a supporting member by going online to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Joined now by the producer of this show and also kind of an adventurer in your own right, Jeff Whittington. Is this as thrilling to you to hear about these stories as it is for me?
Well, I don't say that with Mark Jenkins on the line because I'm a huge fan of Mark Jenkins. I mean, Mark Jenkins rode a bicycle, I think it was like a mid-80s or late 80s model road bike all the way across Siberia and Russia in the 80s and wrote about it. For a book called Off the Map. I've been reading his work for years. He was a regular contributor to Outside Magazine for a number of years, and it's always a thrill to have him on the show to talk about his latest project, and we're really, really lucky, I think, to have his perspective because he has done a lot of climbing. He has done a lot of adventuring, and if you know, Mark Jenkins knows what is hard. It's nothing compared to, I mean, what we're doing here is nothing compared to what these folks are doing. We're just simply trying to get you to support your public radio station. I mean, it's not, you're not going to fall. It's not going to hurt. And it's actually going to continue to bring you conversations like the conversation that you're hearing right now with Mark Jenkins about these incredible and very, very either foolhardy or brave climbers in Yosemite. I mean, they're amazing athletes. They really are incredible athletes, and it's really exciting to be able to have this conversation today. If you appreciate it, then please support the station that's bringing it to you.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can go to kera.org. As most of you probably know, and as Jeff certainly knows, I don't have a physically adventurous bone in my body, but I love to learn about things that I will never try. I might, you know, I've been to Yosemite. I've watched people climb.
Right.
I've scrambled over some rocks in West Texas, but I've never done any kind of technical climbing. But I love these stories. And I think the great thing about public radio is it can give you a view into something that has nothing to do with your experience, and you can still get something from it. Like this idea of having a fear and managing one's fear, I think that's something that all of us can apply to something in our lives, whether or not, you know, we will ever do this thing. And the same thing happens with, you know, we discuss foreign policy on the show and forms of art, and we discuss politics. All of it, whether it relates directly to your life or not, it teaches you something about this world that we live in, and I think that's amazing.
We also know that you, who listen to The Think Show and who listen to KERA here, even in North Texas, have a bit of an adventurous spirit. Anytime we cover Big Bend National Park or camping or hiking or outdoor activities, you know, we always hear from many of you. So I'm really excited that we're able to have this conversation on the show today for you with Mark Jenkins. And we hope that you'll support it with a contribution at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
We have just a little over $150,000 left to raise, and then this fundraising drive, we will have summited this fundraising campaign. Your contribution now in any amount will help us get that much closer to the top. We'd love to hear from you now online at kera.org, or you can call in and make your contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Back in just a couple of minutes to our conversation with Mark Jenkins.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth Programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mark Jenkins. He's a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine who wrote this month's cover story on Yosemite's super climbers. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Mark, aside from being agile, light, and very strong, can you talk about the pros and cons of different kinds of bodies for climbers? I would imagine there's some advantage to being very tall, but also some advantage to having tiny little hands and feet.
Sure. That's an interesting question as well, because climbing, there are many specialties. And if you're a sport climber, for instance, and a sport climber is a person who climbs very vertical or overhanging walls, and much of what you have to hold on to are these little pockets. So a sport climber would need very strong hands, a very strong upper body, but doesn't need really strong legs. And they're useful, but you'll often see sport climbers with kind of toothpick legs. On the other hand, if you take someone who's a mountaineer, where you have to climb or hike very steep mountains before you get to the technical climbing, they often have big legs like a cyclist. So it depends on the kind of climbing you do. The kind of climbing you see in Yosemite is actually kind of a mix. You need to have both a strong upper body and a strong lower body because you've got so much vertical to cover. Sport climbers often only do a pitch or two. A pitch is one rope length, which is 150 feet, whereas in Yosemite, the walls are 3,000 feet tall. Hmm. So you need upper body strength and lower body strength.
And these days you need speed.
Excuse me.
You need speed these days if you want to be at least a free solo climber. It's not taking them the kind of time that it used to take, as you described earlier.
No, yeah, speed has kind of become the new creed of these Uber climbers, I must say. The faster you move, the quicker you're done, obviously, but also the more pitches you can do. It used to be that, for instance, El Capitan, as you mentioned, was first climbed in one day, in 24 hours, in 1975. And then Dean Potter and his partner Sean recently climbed El Cap, the nose route, in about 2.5 hours. So the climbers now are much faster than they used to be. But this is an evolution of the sport, not unlike the evolution of track and field, where the four-minute mile was a great barrier, took a long time to beat, and now it continues to drop. Same sorts of things are happening in rock climbing, where these athletes now, it's not simply about the adventure as it was early in the day when the goal was to explore. Now they know the route, and they may know the route very well. They may have done, like the speed climbers, may have climbed the same route 30 or 40 times. Hmm. The whole goal is to go faster and faster. So there are different goals than we had back in the 60s and 70s when the summit was everything. Now it's also about speed and about style, how you climb it.
How many times up does it take for you to sort of learn a route really well to where you know, okay, my left hand has to move here, my right leg has to go there?
We call that wiring a route when you've done it so many times that you kind of know what's your next move. Where do you put your hand? Where do you put your foot? That's hard to say because each climber is very different. It's how strong is your memory? How intense is your experience? I would say for climbers who climb a lot, three or four times up a route, and they've basically got it wired. But that would be up just one pitch. Now, you have to remember that in 3,000 feet, you've got, say 20, 25 pitches. And in each pitch, there's going to be hundreds of moves. So that's a lot to remember. That's like remembering a very difficult piano concerto. It takes a lot of mental concentration.
You talked about the 60s and 70s in this spirit of exploration and sort of just doing it to have the experience. You write in this article about Camp 4 at Yosemite and how that has really changed. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. Camp 4 is famous to all climbers around the world, really. It's the climbing campground in Yosemite Valley, and it's where climbers have gone since the 50s, actually. And it's now on the historical register, so it's there permanently. And it has evolved. When I first went to Camp 4 in the 70s, it was full of bell-bottom jeans and beads, and it was the post-60s kind of hippie era, and everybody had long hair and headbands, and it was a lot of rock and roll and a lot of it was
drinking and pot smoking. Yeah,
yeah. And you still have part of that. But I must say that over the last 3 or 4 decades, climbing has become mainstream. Most of us have friends who've climbed somewhere. Now, this may just be in your local gym in Houston or something, right? But people understand climbing much better than they did 30, 40 years ago. 30, 40 years ago, it was a rebel activity, right? You were breaking away from football or basketball or something like that as an athlete, and you're saying, no, I'm not going to do those things. I'm going to do my own thing out in the wilderness. Today, what's happened is that one of the consequences of climbing becoming mainstream is that you have mainstream people climbing in Yosemite. You could go to Camp 4 and you can meet a dentist. You can meet an attorney. And they're staying in Camp 4 because they love the buzz of it. They love the excitement. They love the chance to, it's kind of like, Rodeo Drive and Beverly Hills, a chance to rub shoulders with some of the best climbers in the world. And all you got to do is pay $5 a night to have your campsite. It's still cheap.
Are there diehards who resent the fact that it's crowded on the mountain now?
Sure. They're always whiners. But I mean, I think that overall the climbing community does get together to support climbing for everyone in the valley. They have a big cleanup every year now where they invite speakers, famous climbers, Roy Robbins or Yvon Chouinard, all number of famous climbers to come and speak, and they spend a week cleaning up the area. So there are probably some climbers who say, I wish these guys weren't here. But really, it's one big family. And you still see the 25-year-old who hitchhiked out from New York City and is just living in a bivy sack in the boulders and gets up and climbs every day. And he may be, he may pair himself up with a 45-year-old female divorce attorney from New York City. That didn't happen back in the day. And that's the other great change that we've seen in rock climbing and in mountaineering in the last 3 or 4 decades is the advent of very strong, capable women in the sport.
Tell us about Lynn Hill.
Lynn is one of those women. In fact, she's the leader. She's the icon. She was one of the first females to climb very hard, basically to say, I can climb as good as you guys can. And she came to the valley in the 70s, and she's now early 50s, and she did. She was a former gymnast, and she started climbing with some of the best male climbers there and was actually outperformed them in the end. She was capable of doing things that they couldn't do and set records that they could not set. And she was a beacon for all sorts of 15-year-olds all around the world who said, wow, if Lynn can do it, I can do it. And she still climbs very hard. She's a mother, and she's a hero among women. And she kind of opened the door, basically. Now you can go, just go to your local gym. And how many, oftentimes in a local gym, a rock climbing gym, you'll see as many women there as you do men. And that just wasn't the case 30, 40 years ago. It was mostly men. And now you can go to the valley, what I call the valley, the Yosemite Valley, and boy, there are lots and lots of young ladies doing things that most other climbers can't even can dream of.
Is it different for, is the style of climbing any different for a really skilled woman as it is for a really skilled man?
Great question. It is. There is a difference. And we see this when we teach. Sometimes I'll help teach younger kids, like 15-year-olds. And, of course, the guys always try to muscle it. That's what guys do, right?
Yeah.
We're going to muscle our way through. And women are generally smarter. They realize, I can't do 50 pull-ups. I don't have that kind of arm strength. So what I have to rely on is better technique.
Mm-hmm.
And so they often keep their weight on their feet more than trying to just do a pull-up. And that makes for better climbing because as the grades or the difficulty of the route increases, the less you can just rely on brute strength and the more you have to rely on technique. So it's very common to have a class of 10 or 12 people and half of them are women, half of them are men. And the women climb better than the men quite quickly because they're not trying to force their way through. They're focusing and they're using technique, which is what you need for the harder climbs.
What do you have to think about when you're deciding on what sort of partner to take up a mountain with you, who you want to climb with?
Who you want to climb with. Now, this is very personal. I tend to like somebody who's got a good sense of humor. keep me entertained on a portal edge, right? that interpersonal dynamics, and as I say, you never know anyone until you've, you know, shared a tent with them for a week in the rain. That's when you really come to know what a person's like. So clearly they need to be competent, and they need to be confident. One of the things that you try to choose when you're choosing a rock climbing partner is someone who has the same pace as you do. If they're very fast and you're very slow, then they're always going to be upset with you, and vice versa, right? Because you may be waiting at a belay for a very long time. So you want someone who's of comparable or better ability.
Yeah.
Certainly they have to have all the common climbing characteristics of a good climber. They have to be patient. They have to recognize that things don't always work out. You may get hit by a rainstorm and have to sit it out in a portal edge, or you may get hit by a snowstorm and have to descend and say, okay, we're coming back in a week. You have to be adaptable. You have to be willing to improvise. Those are common characteristics of a climber.
We have an email here from Don who says, can you talk about the fact that a mountain climber's job is only half over when he or she gets to the top? How did that guy get back down? I think he's talking about Alex Honnold here. Get back down the face of Half Dome.
Sure. That great letter. Thank you. Yeah, rock climbing in the valley is somewhat interesting because most of the time you can walk down off of these faces. So you don't necessarily, if you're halfway up, you would rappel. You just use your ropes, hook them to the anchors, wrap down, what we call rappelling, and you go back down. But if you go all the way to the top, on most of the features like Half Dome, like El Cap, like the Sentinel that I describe in the story, you can walk off the back. And so Alex just got to the top, and then he walked off the back of Half Dome. It takes several hours to get back down to the base. Now, when you're only what he's describing actually is often what often occurs in mountaineering, where you could have spent like on Everest or some of the big peaks around the world, Denali, for instance, the highest peak in the U.S. up in Alaska. It's common to take 2 or 3 weeks to get to the summit. Now you're going to have to walk back down what you got up there to, the same way you got up. So in many ways, people forget that the summit, if you're thinking of a climb like a marathon, the summit is only 13.1 miles. You still have 13 miles to go back down, and oftentimes it's late in the day. Oftentimes you're extremely tired. Oftentimes you're not as focused. So death in the mountains and on rock climbs, for that matter, often occurs during the descent and not during the ascent, because during the ascent, you're psyched, you're focused, you're strong.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to the top, your strength is ebbing, your focus is diminishing, and you still got to go down.
Mark Jenkins is my guest. He's a contributing writer to National Geographic who wrote the magazine's May 2011 cover story on the super climbers of Yosemite. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment. We have emails already coming in to think@kera.org. You can also call 1-800-933-5372 to join the conversation. I am joined in this conversation now by Jeff Whittington, senior producer of Think, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. So I want to thank Barrett Johnson in Dallas, Clarence Nixon in Fort Worth, Edwin Goff in Dallas, and Sharon and Kendrick Parkham in Grand Prairie. They've called 888-694-6931, or perhaps they've contributed online at kera.org during the show today. Also, thanks to Sally Kittles in Dallas, Harris Block in Dallas, and Yi Zong in Frisco. I want to thank each of you. Of course, we want to thank everybody who's done their part to support KERA over the last couple of weeks during this membership campaign. We would love to hear from you today. We have just $150,050 left to raise in the drive. And when you consider the fact that we started with a goal of $625,000, we've made really significant progress. And just with a few more of you participating in your public radio station in the success of this drive, we can bring this drive to a successful conclusion.
All of that progress we've made is, in fact, because of you who listen. We ask everyone who listens regularly to KERA to make a contribution. Your contribution might be at the friends level of $1,500. It might be, you know, $50. It might be whatever amount works for you. You decide that, but your support pays for the programming that you rely on. You know, Jeff, I was thinking about this. I know that you also have a smartphone, you know, and once you make the transition, you can't go back. Like,
oh, yeah.
If you were to drop your iPhone, would you not run out and get another one?
Well, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, you know,
I think it's sort of the same way with KERA. You can sort of take it for granted and think it's great, but if suddenly it were gone, you would pay almost any amount of money to get it back because you're so accustomed to it and you know how important it is in your life.
Yeah, the iPhone is not a phone. It's a lifestyle. And you know what? Public radio is not a radio station. It's a lifestyle. It's part of your life. It's part of your identity. It's who you are, and it's something that you would truly, truly miss. Chris has a great point. If it were gone, you would probably take that step to help ensure that KERA and public radio return to the airwaves in North Texas.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make your contribution at kera.org. People hear that our goal is $625,000. Is that a huge amount of money? Absolutely. Do we have huge bills to pay in order to provide your service in public radio? Absolutely. There's very large bills that have to go to all the national producers of programming. You know, we try to keep our expenses as low as possible here, but it's not cheap to make a local show. You know, you have to Jeff and I are devoted full-time to this project. That's two salaries right there. We also have, of course, we have Nilufer Arsala, our engineer. We have some other folks. Joe Bilotti is answering the phones. And we have, you know, just the day-to-day expenses of keeping the station running. You did some calculations the other day about, you know, the electricity at the tower to broadcast everywhere.
Yeah, it's a huge bill. And I've never seen the electric bill for KERA, but I don't know that I want to. I mean, that's a responsibility that is pretty awesome, to pay the bills. What we do here is ask you to help cover the cost of some of these things. You know, 61 cents of every dollar we spend comes directly from your contributions. And that's why it's so crucial that we hear from you, because when we have a $1,000 bill for something, well, 610 of those dollars are coming directly from your contributions. That's how it works. That's what makes public radio so great, because we're not trying to please a whole bunch of advertisers. We're just trying to please you.
That's right. We do get some support from corporate underwriting and from foundations. We get some money from the government. I like to think about it, you know, if 61 cents out of every dollar comes from you, we work really hard, other members of our team here, to give you a 39-cent discount on the dollar for what you listen to. So your contribution really just helps to pay the rest of your public radio bill. 1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go online to kera.org.
888-694-6931. Online at kera.org, just $149,900 left to raise in this membership campaign. We can get there and bring this campaign to a successful conclusion with your participation right now. Again, the number is 888-694-6931, or go to kera.org. And thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth Programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is National Geographic writer Mark Jenkins, who wrote the cover story in this month's issue. It's about Yosemite's super climbers. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We were speaking earlier, Mark, about the portaledge, and one of the climbers that's in that portaledge is Kevin Jorgensen, who, by the way, for anyone who can't get enough of this stuff, is giving a slideshow presentation this evening at 7 o'clock at Texas Mountaineers and Dallas Rocks. You can find, we'll put a link up on the Think page of KERA.org to find out about that appearance. So it would be a nice little compliment to this conversation. We also have an email here from your Aunt Loretta, Mark, who says she was very excited to be able to tune in to the program. And this is very Garrison Keillor, but she's looking forward to seeing you in Wyoming in a couple of weeks.
That's classic, right? My father's getting an award for being a mathematician for 40 years, and she'll be up. So it's nice to communicate this way.
So, were you born into a family of adventurers, or is your dad kind of a desk guy?
I think he's both. He's obviously very cerebral. He's a mathematician and even has some theorems named after him. But he also took our family on sabbatical every 7 years. So he spent a year in Holland and twice went to South Africa. So he's got both going on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Another email here from Robert says, could you please describe your most vivid and magical climbing experience?
You know, I get asked that, and it's really so hard because it's like asking someone what's their favorite song. If I go to Yosemite, I must say that As I describe in the story, climbing with Dean Potter up the Sentinel, which is 15 pitches, was really extraordinary because we moved so quickly together. And I'd never climbed that fast for that many pitches. We did 15 pitches in 4 hours. And we got to the top, and it was just a flash. It was just, we just flew up the, and I'd never myself climbed at that speed. And I have to say, it was stunning. You take risks, though, when you move at that speed. You have to be very focused that you don't make any tiny mistake. And when you're moving quickly, you can often make a mistake. We didn't, but it happens.
Yeah, and that was a climb. It's such a great story because you had tried that as a teenager and had to back down.
Yeah, I think it's easy to climb in your local area. Where I grew up in Wyoming, where you kind of feel like, okay, I'm ready. Now I'm going to do my big pilgrimage. You know, I'm going to go to Mecca. I'm going to go to Yosemite Valley. And you usually have some climb that you want to do because it's the Holy Grail. And I got there, and I was a young man, and I'd hitchhiked out. And I was not capable of climbing what I thought I could climb. And I'm not the only one who's experienced that, I must say. Eventually did climb it with Dean. But this is the thing about Yosemite. Is the walls are so magical. And they're so massive. I mean, they can kind of scare you when you stand at the bottom of them. They are so big. And you've got to be there for a while. You've got to be there for weeks to kind of start to feel comfortable around these monsters.
Do you get the same feeling looking straight up from the very bottom as you do looking down from the very top?
No, not at all. I don't think. I mean, one interesting thing I should say that circles back to this fear of heights thing, that the top and the bottom. When you climb up a big face, your mind and your spirit slowly adjust to being off the ground. So you'll climb up 150 feet. That's a pitch. Then you'll belay your partner up, and he'll go up, and you'll do another pitch. And so you're actually ascending off the ground relatively slowly, and your mind kind of adjusts. So after 4 or 5 hours, let's say you're up 500 feet, 600 feet, maybe 1,000 feet, your mind has been adjusting all this time. So you can look over the edge, and you're hanging off the edge, and you're not bothered by it. But say you were to suddenly just be forced to the edge of something, having not kind of adjusted along the way, you'll feel vertigo.
Yeah.
So you have a very different sense of things when you move up a wall versus when you're just kind of, you know, as a typical tourist, you're at the top of a skyscraper and you just go look over the edge. It'll give you that sense of vertigo. But if you were climbing that wall, slowly but surely your mind adjusts.
Talk about this. You're not supposed to do this, or one is not supposed to do this, but there are people who get to the top at Yosemite and then parachute off.
And jump off. It's called base jumping, right? Mm-hmm. It is illegal in Yosemite. It's not illegal everywhere, but this is the fastest way of descending. You don't have to walk off or rappel. You have a little parachute. You run at top speed, or you just dive off of something that's overhanging, and you free fall for... till you're within about 500 feet, 600 or 700 feet, depends on what your skill is and how big your parachute is, and you pull the ripcord, and you drop down. Now, this is illegal in Yosemite National Park. We do have a picture of it in the magazine. It's becoming a popular sport, although it has its dangers as well. If you pull your ripcord too late, you will hit the trees or hit the ground at too high an impact and kill yourself. There aren't that many people who are really good at rock climbing and really good at base jumping, and the combination is very special. Dean Potter, for instance, is one of those people I describe who's got extraordinary skill as a climber as well as a base jumper. He is he has jumped off of the Eiger, for instance, in Switzerland. There aren't that many people who have that combination. It's pretty specialized.
Have you tried it?
No, I haven't.
Are you tempted?
I skydived, but I haven't base jumped. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it takes a lot of time. I was talking to Dean about it, and he said, you know, you should probably do 200 to 300 jumps out of a plane before you even consider jumping off of a fixed object.
Wow.
BASE actually is an acronym standing for building antenna something. I'm sorry, I can't remember it. But it means you're jumping off a stationary object, and you don't have that. Typically, when you jump from a plane, you're jumping from 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 feet. You have plenty of time to pull your ripcord. When you jump from a very low elevation, you have to be completely aware of how close you are to the ground. And you're going at you know, 33 feet per second per second. So you're just dropping like a rock.
Hmm. I know that often on Nat Geo assignments, the photographer and the reporter are not together. Were you and Jimmy Chin at any point during this assignment working together?
We were. In fact, Jimmy and I know each other, and we'd wanted to do an assignment together for years. So this worked out perfectly. We were in Yosemite together a bunch, and we were up. I was up with him when he was taking pictures. Oftentimes, we were discussing how to tell the story, because it's a big story, really. There are so many characters. Who could we include? Who don't we have room to include? It was a complete effort together, really. We were... I discussed the pictures he'd taken. He'd discuss what I was thinking about writing about, and it was a very special time. We were both there for over a month.
So we have these photographs throughout the article that are deliciously vivid, and they sort of give you that little tingle. What does it take to not only have climbed higher than the people he's about to shoot, but to be holding a camera and balancing it? Is that a whole? Is he tied in somehow when he's he pulls out his camera?
This is typical of great National Geographic photographers. But, for instance, to get pictures of somebody on El Cap, mm-hmm. halfway up, that means that Jimmy had to hike around to the top. It takes hours and hours with a bunch of gear. Usually he'll hire a couple climbers to help him carry some of that gear up. And then he'll have thousands of feet of rope, and he'll rappel down. Hmm. He'll just jump off the top and start rappelling down and get himself in position to take a picture that might only be there for 15 minutes. Hmm. So this was a special assignment. But Jimmy grew up shooting pictures. He's a great climber himself, and he grew up shooting in Yosemite. So he's got all the skills. He's got all the climbing technique. You could never get a non-climber photographer to get those pictures, because you have to have extraordinary skill as a climber just to get in position to shoot. I know he could spend 2 or 3 days just to get in the right location to do a picture.
Are most climbers that you speak to really articulate about describing what their experience is, or is there a special sort of set of skills you need to get to understanding what they're thinking when they're up there?
Again, that's probably pretty individual. I would say that there's a climbing lingo. Mm-hmm. There's a language that explains... You know, when you sit around with a bunch of climbers, they'll be saying, well, I was right at the crux, and I had a finger lock here, and I was stemming here. And you kind of need to know what those terms mean to understand what position they were in. In terms of how they speak about the emotional experience of climbing, that kind of depends on how articulate they are. Some mm-hmm. people are quite quiet, and it's all about the personal revelation, and they don't feel a need to share it. Other people are boisterous, and their whole dream is to sit down and tell you a war story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So certainly there is a language that you need to understand what climbers are up to. But on the kind of macro level, I think we all have challenges in life which we put ourselves up against and try our hardest, and if we succeed, we feel great. And that's very human, and that's what all humans can understand. And climbers are doing the same thing. They're just tackling challenges that I think most people find fearful, because we all have a fear of falling.
Well, Mark, I really enjoyed reading the piece, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you about it for this past hour. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Chris. It was good to be with you.
Mark Jenkins wrote the cover story for this month's National Geographic magazine about the super climbers of Yosemite. Thanks to all of you this hour who have participated by listening to the show, by sending in emails, by interacting. Thanks especially to those of you who have supported the show and made sure that we'll be able to bring you guests like Mark Jenkins, who's been on the show before. Your contribution makes it possible. When you go online to kera.org with your debit or credit card, or when you call 1-888-694-6931, you are part of our team that makes it possible for us to bring you this content every single day, and makes it possible for you to count on us. We count on you just the same. I should probably set aside all these climbing metaphors, but it's but it's true in a way that, you know, in the same way that two different climbers will rely on one another, we rely on you as much as you rely on this station.
That's right. I mean, it's up to you to make sure that KERA is strong and healthy now and into the future. And, you know, the way we do it is one contribution at a time, one call to 888-694-6931, or one online contribution at kera.org. Just $149,885 left to go. That means we've done about $2,000, thanks to many of you. We've raised about $2,000 during the Think Show today. Would love to do a few more $1,000 during the show today. If you can afford to give at a higher level, maybe it's time for you to renew your Friends level membership, or maybe you've been considering joining at that level. This would be a great time to do it. That's a $1,500 annual contribution. Just go online to kera.org or call 888-694-6931. Do whatever you can for the station, because, you know, even your $100 contribution, joined with 10 or 12 other people who do that, you get the job done as well.
I have a special challenge to all of you who, in every drive, wish us well and can't wait for it to be over and hope that we make the money we need, but have never quite seen fit to make a contribution. I would ask those of you especially, if you want it to happen, make it happen. That's how things happen, that people recognize that certain things are important, and then they decide to take action. You can make certainly a very significant contribution if that's within your budget, but you can also make what might feel to you like a modest contribution that will get added into the pot with everyone else and will allow the station to continue to serve you in the ways that you've become accustomed to and will be strong and vibrant and allow us to grow the programming that we're able to bring you. The place to do that is kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Chris, we put a link up to National Geographic magazine online on the Think page as well as a link to Dallas Rocks Indoor Climbing Center, where Kevin Jorgensen, who's featured in the article, is going to give a talk tonight. So there's a link to both of these items up on the Think page, kera.org/think. You should go check out the National Geographic article if you have a moment and look at some of these photographs, and you can see those when you go to the link. Or, you can get the information on how to get how to go see him speak tonight, because he's going to be speaking, not our guest, but Kevin Jorgensen, one of the climbers, is going to be speaking here in Dallas tonight. We're really excited to be able to have this conversation today with Mark Jenkins. And you know what? It's your contributions that make it possible. We had to call him on a landline in Montana. And, you know, we do call guests on the show quite regularly, but we have to pay that phone bill when we do that. Sometimes it's an overseas call, and it's there's an expense that comes with that. But to bring you these kinds of important guests and topics that appeal to you right here in North Texas, it's worth it, because we hear from you and you support it. Well, we're asking you to do that right now with a contribution to help offset some of these costs at 888-694-6931 or on kera.org.
Another, expense that the station has, maybe you could think to yourself, I'll pick that up. I'll pick that up for the Think team. I'll pick that up for KERA. Magazine subscriptions. I think some of them that we bring to you come into us, and they're complimentary subscriptions. Others, magazines and publications that Jeff and I read in order to stay current and think about good ideas. Some of those, the station pays for. There's also this idea that, things that may not be directly related to the content of the show are things that we need to inform ourselves about just to get ideas for who you might want to talk to, what you might want to hear about. And so your contribution will help make this possible. Will the drive end today? Will it end tomorrow? Will it end Thursday? Some of that is within your control. If you want to call right now and make a $150,000 contribution, we're done. But honestly, if you make a contribution to $150. You think about this: $150. If 1,000 people do that right now, we're done. And there are 1,000 people, well over 1,000 people listening at this moment. If 2,000 people, well over 2,000 people listening at this moment, do a $75 contribution, we're done. It really, if you start to think about it in those terms, there's not that much left to raise. And your contribution can be modest and still significant.
Yeah, every contribution at whatever amount really does make a huge impact, because it's with your contribution, with the thousands of other people who support the station, that's what makes it work. You have a logarithmic exponential impact on how public radio here in North Texas and how KERA is able to manage to survive, because when you join, you're not just doing it alone, and we would never ask you to do it on your own. You're joining with a whole bunch of other people here in North Texas who believe, just like you do, that public radio is very important. So please go online right now to KERA.org and make a contribution in support of this show and all the shows you hear on KERA.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA Dallas-Fort Worth Denton, 100.1 K261 CW Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR Wichita Falls, 99.3 K257 EV Sherman. Your contribution now makes a difference. It keeps your public radio station strong. Love to hear from you at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.